This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. The holidays mean more travel, more shopping, more time online, and more personal info in places that could expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second. If your identity is stolen, their U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed or your money back. Get more holiday fun and less holiday worry with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
I'm Greg Dalton.
I'm Ariana Brocious.
And this is Climate One. Climate change means extreme weather, economic instability, social havoc, and all that disruption is being driven by our continued use of fossil fuels. The industry is so deeply entrenched in all aspects of our lives that getting off fossil fuels can feel slow, complicated, even impossible.
But there are multiple ways to drive change. As an individual, you can get fossil fuels out of your home and your driveway. You can dump oil and gas stocks from your portfolio.
You can push elected representatives to focus on climate, and you can vote with your wallet and your fork.
Right. Eat less meat and buy less stuff. That has a big impact on climate. Today, we're going to feature two people taking different approaches to fighting fossil fuels. One is young climate activist Nayeli Kobo. We had her on the show last year. She was part of a grassroots effort to get oil wells in her Los Angeles community shut down, and she succeeded.
It's really powerful to know that a community that was viewed as invisible, as disposable, created historical change.
And she hasn't stopped. Now she's working to defend a statewide California oil and gas setback law from being repealed by the industry. We'll hear a bit from her later in the show.
She has this calm, fierce power and presence. She and her neighbors are fighting to open windows in their own homes. It is a life or death situation for them. Today, we're also featuring someone from the opposite end of the power spectrum, so to speak, from the highest legal authority in California, Attorney General Rob Bonta.
We've talked a lot on the show about how much fossil fuel companies knew about the climate-harming effects of their products, how early they knew, decades and decades ago, and how they've spent the last half century systematically deceiving the public to protect their interests. Now we're starting to see a series of lawsuits seeking to hold those companies to account for their deception. Just last week, Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel announced she too plans to sue Big Oil. Michigan would be the ninth state to do that, though of course California is the biggest.
Right. California is the fifth largest economy in the world, and it's a major oil producer. So this suit is a big deal. Last fall, the state's Attorney General Rob Bonta filed a lawsuit against five of the world's largest oil and gas companies, along with the lobbying organization, the American Petroleum Institute. During the recent San Francisco Climate Week, I invited him to join me in front of a live audience at the Commonwealth Club to talk about his approach. You filed the civil lawsuit that alleges ExxonMobil, Shell, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, BP, and importantly, the American Petroleum Institute have known since the 1960s, I actually think there's evidence they knew in the 50s,
right,
that burning fossil fuels could warm the planet. Then instead of alerting the public, they chose to downplay or outright deny the effects. Can you give us an overview of the suit and what it alleges?
Absolutely. The short of it is that these fossil fuel companies and the API, the American Petroleum Institute, they knew about global warming and predicted with terrifying accuracy where we would be today with extreme weather and global warming and climate change, and they lied about it. It was bad for business. They knew internally, they acknowledged internally with memos and conversations the truth of climate change, but externally to the public, to the world, they lied and they denied climate change. And they didn't just fail to talk about it. They had a very sophisticated, strategic public relations approach to how they denied it. They hired a firm and they created front groups and they placed and planted op-eds, all saying the opposite of what they internally acknowledged. And so this is a climate change deception case. We have filed it in San Francisco Superior Court. We are the biggest geographic entity and biggest economy to sue these fossil fuel companies for this conduct. We think it's a game changer. We think it's a massive transformational moment in terms of accountability. And we believe in a simple premise. One, you shouldn't lie to the people of this state, of this country, of this world. And two, you should be held accountable and pay for the damage that you created because of that deception and because of those lies. So a cornerstone of our case is our public nuisance claim, which has a remedy of an abatement fund, a fund to pay for mitigation and abatement to address climate change repercussions that have harmed so many of us. Of course, now we know we're seeing droughts and floods and wildfires and superstorms, and homes are being washed away or burned, and farms are being impacted, our infrastructure, our roads.
Can I just jump in there, though? You know, public nuisance sounds like, you know, noisy neighbors next door and dog poo on the sidewalk. It doesn't sound like a serious thing. You know, so what is it about nuisance as a legal term? Because nuisance sounds like, you're a pain, but, you know, it's not a big deal.
It's very serious, and it's been applied in major actions like this in the past. So it is essentially a harm to a community or a neighborhood that's been created by a single entity. That is exactly what's happening here with fossil fuel companies creating harm to all of Californians and beyond. And it's not an unprecedented novel approach. It's been used with tobacco. It's been used with opioids. It's been used with lead paint. Other entities, big corporate entities that have harmed people with a product that they knew was harming them, and continue to perpetuate it and push it out into the marketplace anyway. So it's a tried and true approach, and the abatement fund could be seeded with billions of dollars from the fossil fuel industry.
Okay, and we'll get into that later. So nuisance is more serious in a legal term than it means to kind of the average person. There's also fraudulent, you're claiming business practices, damage to natural resources, and product liability. So this seems like you're actually throwing a lot of different things to see what sticks.
That's it. There's four buckets of legal claims. There's the public nuisance claim. There's a series of claims around fraud and deception and false advertising. There's a failure to warn products liability bucket of claims. And then the fourth is a special cause of action that is unique only to the Attorney General of the state of California to be able to protect our natural resources when they're harmed by an entity. So four buckets, the most broad sweeping set of claims ever in this space, again, brought by the largest geographic entity and economy. Our complaint's very thorough, over 135 pages. There's a set of 15 to 20 pages, which lay out in excruciating detail that will make your blood boil. The facts dating back from the 50s, 60s about what the fossil fuel companies that are defense in the case, what they knew when they knew it, how they acknowledged that, citations and quotes to internal memos, to internal discussions, and then what they did instead to lie to the people to bypass clean energy pathways and opportunities for carbon capture and development of other technologies in pursuit of billions of dollars in profits. And their business model has been very successful. They have captured billions of dollars in profits while socializing the costs to the people of California, America, and the world.
And we've seen this before. A lot of this follows on the tobacco playbook, where they go from deny to delay to deflect. There's lots of D words that come up here. And then in 1998, Big Tobacco agreed to a grand bargain and pay more than $200 billion over 25 years. It's known as a master settlement. Complicated, but there's similarities. Lots of states, and then they eventually rolls up into one big settlement. This happens in asbestos and other things.
Yep.
So how relevant is the tobacco precedent for what you're trying to do on oil?
Very relevant. And we can't talk about our lawsuit without talking about tobacco, without talking about opioids, without talking about lead paint. And you know, the similarities with tobacco are striking. The use of front groups, the use of strategic public relations.
Some of the very same lawyers.
The same ones. It's the same playbook. It's an off-the-shelf playbook used by corporations when they know about a fact that is very problematic to their business model, that they know that they're hurting people. And if people knew that, they would make different decisions. So they set about to lie. Merchants of doubt, undermining the science and providing studies that they commission and op-eds that they place in key newspapers to suggest an alternative reality.
Influencing elite universities with research funding, yeah.
So paying for their own studies. They don't like the actual facts, they pay for alternative facts. And it's wrong. And the pathway that tobacco took, where multiple entities worked together, teamed up, applied aggregated pressure over time and across geographic spaces. We're in the middle of that process now, I believe. Our entry, I think, opens up the floodgates for others to join. And if other states who are invited to join and other entities who are invited to join add their voice, then I think we get into the same place as we were with tobacco.
But there's a big difference between tobacco and oil is that a lot of people never smoked, right? You know, and everybody uses fossil fuels. I've owned an electric car for more than a decade. I still use fossil fuels. I still fly, you know, so tobacco and oil are different. The economy runs on oil in a way that it never ran on tobacco. And we're complicit. You and I are both complicit. So how do you get to that?
I mean, it's not about who's using fossil fuels. You know, like you said, it's universal. It's ubiquitous. And that's part of the lie here, is it to tell people it's okay to use fossil fuel because climate change is not real. It's not really happening. Or it's not happening as quickly, or it's not as urgent. Or we are now, you know, today's greenwashing lies. You know, a fossil fuel is actually clean energy. Natural gas is clean energy. Or we're in the middle of a massive transformation into clean energy futures when only, you know, 1% or less of their investments are actually in clean energy and 99% remains with fossil fuels. So, you know, we are the state of California suing. California is a fossil fuel producing state. We're the home of Chevron. And both things can be true at once, that you can hold fossil fuel companies accountable for their conduct, for their lies, for the damage that they visited on the people of the state and this nation, and acknowledge the truth that got us here, which is that, you know, fossil fuels are ubiquitously used.
There's a difference also in the mechanism of harm. When I smoke a cigarette, smoke goes into my lungs, it causes cancer, right? We burn fossil fuels, it goes up in the sky, something happens, and suddenly the San Mateo coast is eroding and, you know, we have droughts. And so how do you know that this company or this refinery caused this flood or this damage, therefore to assign damage in a court case?
Yeah. You know, that'll be part of what we have experts to talk about, you know, the depth and the exact scope of the damage, the causation that exists. There is no doubting climate science and climate change, although the whole business model of the fossil fuel companies has been to doubt it. If you believe in facts, evidence, science, and data, you can't doubt it. And so that will be a part of the discussion, how much each entity pays into the abatement fund, how much Chevron is responsible, and how much, you know, Shell is responsible. I'm happy to have them pointing the finger at one another to talk about who's more responsible than the other. But the damage in aggregate will be clear, the impact on Californians. You know, we have data that shows the impacts of wildfires, the impacts of floods, the impacts of superstorms. It is knowable. And so we will present that to a court and make our case.
Ben Santer is a climate scientist formerly at Livermore National Lab who kind of pioneered in fingerprinting. And he says that climate science in courts is kind of like where DNA evidence was 25 or 30 years ago. It was this complex science. People didn't know how to use it in courts. And now DNA evidence is kind of common and used all sorts of ways, right, to get people convicted or let out. And he says climate science will be like DNA science and used in courts. So tell me a little bit about this fund, who pays into it, and who decides where the money goes, because that's often a big issue, is like, okay, got a big pot of money, you know, in smokers, it's pretty clear, like it's gone toward education, stop kids from smoking. Where would you direct the fund if you were successful?
You know, this is something that will be the product of discussions at the time that we secure the abatement fund, which is not today. It'll be a couple years down the road.
Might be decades, some people say.
We don't think so. we think 3 to 5 years. We want to move expeditiously. The abatement fund will be used based on the need to address all of the variety of harms of climate change, to abate and mitigate. It could be things like cooling centers and clean air centers, forest management, seawalls could be possible, water storage to address drought. Any of the challenges from, you know, drought to wildfires to floods to superstorms that have a mitigation, those are potential areas for investment.
And you've worked out environmental justice. What about communities that have been most harmed? Because we have 5 refineries here in the East Bay. They're concentrated in a certain area. You know, it is downwind from Pacific Heights and Marin. What about those communities that have been frontline and harmed most by fossil fuels?
Absolutely. The communities that are hurt first and worst, that are under-resourced and overburdened, that live at the intersection of poverty and pollution, are top priority for relief and for support. It's an appropriate allocation of resources to help those harmed the most and who have the least ability to respond and provide them substantial resources up front.
By one count, there are more than 30 cases against oil companies filed by states, cities, and tribal nations. Been a lot of procedural, try to slow it down. Massachusetts and the city of Honolulu have moved past a lot of those motions and they're for dismissal and reached pre-trial discovery phase. Now, this is where things get interesting because this is when boxes of documents start to show up and emails get revealed. So what are you looking for in discovery? Because these are when the so-called smoking guns come out and things get really interesting.
Yeah, it's exciting. And that there's 30, I think you'll see double, triple, quadruple that in terms of entities that sue as they learn more about the case and they see the momentum that we're building and they see that you can get to the substance and hold accountable these fossil fuel companies. I'll say first that when we sue, we feel we will win in court at the time of suit, that we've done our due diligence, we've done our investigation, we've developed the factual case and bases for our claims, and we feel, you know, we could go to trial very soon, that we don't need discovery to prevail. Discovery is another way to build on our causes of action, maybe identify other causes of action and amend the complaint, to add belt and suspenders to the facts that we already have. So, you know, we're looking for more smoking guns. And I say more deliberately. We have smoking guns. We have those memos that show that in the 50s and 60s, these fossil fuel companies are acknowledging the future of climate change and extreme weather and global warming. They knew then where we would be today. And they said it. And we have documents that prove it. So are there more documents? Is there additional indication of that theme of knowing about climate change and lying? Surely there's more. And we expect to find some of those documents in discovery. And what becomes available in other cases, you know, to the extent it's not confidential and it's public, becomes evidence.
Sometimes in the American system, a lot of the most egregious transgressions are legal. You know, a lot of what happened in the great financial crisis of 2009 was legal, right? So proving lying is one thing. The part for me that were the strongest case is policy obstruction. You know, I talked to one lawyer for Chevron who said, look, you know, this should not be in the courts. Congress should address climate change. It's too technical for the courts. And I said, I agree with you. And, you know, if that's the case, you really believe that, then the American Petroleum Institute, which you're a member of, should stop trying to smear electric cars and slow down progress and all these sorts of things. So isn't it possible that what they did, you know, is part of our system to slow down policy that's not in their interest? That's legal. That's okay by our system.
Oh, no. I mean, the fossil fuel companies are allowed to make their comments known to policymakers, to lobby them, to petition their government for the positions that they want. That is completely separate from this lawsuit. The fossil fuel companies want, and shared with you exactly what they've been sharing since day one, they want you and others to wrongly believe that this lawsuit has something to do with policy. It doesn't. This is a lawsuit based on a cause of action and a legal claim and the facts that support it that lead to a remedy.
Some people say impact litigation is partly about chipping away what's called the social license to operate. You know, these companies operate partly because society allows them to operate. And, you know, whether it's gun manufacturers or opioid, et cetera, that can erode, and public support can erode for these companies. And that's one tactic. You know, how much do you think about the social license to operate that could be eroded where consumers, investors start to say like, ooh, you know, we don't want to be part of these companies. It's not so much about the legal case winning in court. It's about a broader social or even moral question.
I mean, I think those are all part of the bigger picture. We are occupying one lane in this broader sort of discussion and dialogue about climate change, our global future, the role of fossil fuels in bringing us to the brink to where we are. There's a whole set of others, as we know, where, you know, socially conscious investment is a part of the theory of change. Do we have our big pension funds invest in fossil fuel, or do we divest? Or, you know, what do boards want from their companies? How are they going to hold these fossil fuel companies accountable? What do shareholders do? Those are all separate from us, but they're part of the broader discussion. And then there's also policy and law being created in Congress and state legislatures throughout the state. So all different ways to address a problem that we are collectively facing, but we are in a very unique and distinct lane of litigation.
You're listening to a conversation with California Attorney General Rob Bonta about the state's lawsuit against big oil companies. Coming up, the shifting economics of the energy industry.
The system is changing as we speak, under our feet. It is becoming more expensive to be dirty than clean.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
While it is true that fossil fuel companies engage in deceptive practices to protect their profits, it can be hard to change a business that's embedded in and profiting from our carbon economy.
Right, and they produce a product that is used by everyone every day. Without them, schools can't educate and hospitals can't heal. I talked about this with California Attorney General Rob Bonta. He's currently suing five major oil companies and their lobbying organization. I asked him how he would handle the transition if he were CEO of a major oil company.
If I was a CEO, I would say we're an energy company, and energy can be created in ways that preserve our planet and ways that destroy our planet. And we should embrace the pathway that preserves our planet, protects it, and move away from fossil fuel and into clean energy and be an extremely successful billion-dollar clean energy, sustainable energy, green energy company to provide energy for California, the United States, and the world.
BP tried that, you know, became Beyond Petroleum, right? And you know, Lord Brown, who I've actually sat with here on this stage, you know, and you could say that they were flawed in their implementation. And what part of the problem was that Wall Street, you know, dirty still makes more money than clean because dirty doesn't play the full price of the pollution that they socialize and put into the atmosphere we're using as an unpriced sewer. So CEO Rob Bonta, you could say that, and I'm Wall Street, I'm like, because you're not going to make as much money. So the system traps these individuals. So don't we need to change the system? Because it's really the financial model that, you know, any company that wants to kind of do more renewables, as big and powerful these companies are, they're still in an even larger system.
The system is changing as we speak, under our feet. It is becoming more expensive to be dirty than clean. Mm-hmm. You know, this abatement fund remedy is billions of dollars to the bottom line of fossil fuel companies. That's a cost. That's a cost they have to report. They have to share with their shareholders. The divestment of you know, pension funds and others are costs. There are subsidies for investments in clean energy and green energy. So the economic point is an important one. I think that is becoming less imbalanced over time. But there's also just a corporate responsibility. Like, do you want a planet for your kids and grandkids, for your workers' kids and grandkids? Do you want to be part of the thing that ended our planet and our future? Or did you transform and change and embrace a clean energy future?
ConocoPhillips is one of the companies you're suing. And I actually spoke to a board member of ConocoPhillips, who's an amazing guy who doesn't like going to gas stations, drives an electric car, and says that energy companies are terrible at making money. Look at their return on capital for the last 10 years. And that they will not play a role in the energy transition because it's not good at what they do. They're not good at solar. They do these like multi-billion dollar massive projects. He thinks they're ill-equipped to be part of an energy transition. And he's on the board of one of these companies. He basically wants the last oil to come out of the ground to be American, for American jobs. We do it better and cleaner than other places, and to make money doing it. My point is, like, these companies are not monoliths. They're like people with different interests. How much interaction do you even have conversations with oil companies, you know, back channel, et cetera? Or is it kind of like, we don't talk to you because you're suing us?
Oh, we've talked to them. I've talked to the fossil fuel industry leaders in Sacramento as a legislator. I've talked to them as an AG. We take meetings. We have an open door policy. We listen. We're willing to learn. We're open-minded. We're happy to have those conversations. We're happy to listen to possible pathways for the future. But to that point about not being equipped, that's today. Get equipped. Bring the talent in. That happens all the time in companies as you need to be nimble and adapt. Legacy approaches are not the ones for the future, and there's disruptors enter the marketplace. You have to adjust. So adjust. Don't say we can't do it. Get prepared to do it and make the change.
As you mentioned, California is an oil state, produces more oil than many people realize in the Central Valley. How about the workers? There's a transition for them. Sometimes they hear these conversations like, you think I'm bad. You know, you think I'm a bad person because I work in oil, right? So what do you say to the rank and file workers, you know, who feel, wait, you're trying to sue my company and put me out of business? I'm out of a job.
The workers are absolutely critical. And solving that piece of the puzzle, critical. Often referred to generally as the just transition. I don't think anyone who works in oil is bad. I don't pass any judgment on anyone who wants to work and support their family. Many are getting good jobs in the fossil fuel industry, and they deserve good jobs in the clean energy.
Union jobs, well-paying, a lot better than the clean energy jobs are not union and don't pay so well.
No doubt about the fact that the fossil fuel jobs are often union and well paid with benefits and healthcare. We need to make sure that those jobs, that there's no loss, that everyone is continued to made whole as the transition occurs. That could look like a number of different things. The most important thing is that we don't talk about it, we do it. That there are good jobs in wind energy, and that you get the same health care and benefits and pay and union protections, and then in solar or whatever else it is that we pursue in clean energy. It might mean that there needs to be some government subsidies to protect and support workers, to make sure that none of them are treated less than they are now in fossil fuel when they take a job in clean energy. Some folks who may not have a lot of career left and for whom retraining might not be appropriate, maybe they just get a massive payout. That could be a wise investment in our future by government to be part of the solution and to support it with subsidies.
And one thing I'm keen on is geothermal. We have a fair amount of geothermal in this state, and that's actually a place where oil and gas skills are transferable. And there are people, we've interviewed people who've gone from oil and gas to geothermal, and that's actually a very real pathway, maybe more for individuals than for companies. Your mother helped organize Filipino and Mexican-American farm workers for United Farm Workers. How does that influence your work on environmental justice?
Well, one, it makes me very sensitive to and supportive of workers, to make sure that they are treated with dignity and respect, are supported and valued and seen throughout this whole process. That's item number one. Number two is, I grew up in La Paz in the headquarters of United Farm Workers of America. My dad worked in the front office with Cesar Chavez, my mom in the preschool with Dolores Huerta. We were there in the early 70s. We lived in a trailer. My parents got paid $5 a week for their work with the United Farm Workers. And some of their work involved things that we might call environmental injustice today. The fact that there were workers working in extreme heat, or with exposure to pesticides, or without getting access to water breaks. That was environmental justice before it was environmental justice. And making sure that those disadvantaged communities, the communities that are under-resourced, overburdened, living in communities where there's massive impact, of the pesticides and the challenges, that helped me become sensitive to and excited and passionate about doing climate action and making sure that we have justice as we pursue climate action that preserves our planet, and making sure that we always look through that equity lens and support our disadvantaged communities who are hurt first and worst.
Looking ahead, there's a possible change in administration. You will be the person that will defend California's waiver under the Clean Air Act to have stricter pollution laws because our air here is so bad in the LA Basin and the Central Valley. What are you anticipating for a possible situation where usually California is kind of aligned with the feds, or sometimes they're like this, and we go like this, and we go like this, back and forth. We may be entering in a period where the waiver is going to be rescinded, which a lot of California's climate policy rests on our ability to have stricter standards here. What are you worried about looking ahead at November?
Let me first say that with the Biden administration, I'm super supportive of the Biden administration generally. We're talking about environment, so supportive of the great work that they've done to move away from the Trump era rules and lean into climate action that helps address our climate change problems. And as friends, it's sometimes important for friends to push friends to do more. California is always the most aggressive, on the leading edge, doing the most, on the front foot, and we want to push other states to do something similar, our federal government to do the same, and other nations around the world. So that has always been our mantra. It's part of our legacy in addressing climate change, protecting our natural resources. My hope is that the Biden administration continues their great work and has four more years to do it. That is not the only possibility of the general election coming up in November. So we have to be prepared for an alternative. And I guess fortunately and unfortunately, we had 4 years to see what that could look like in an iteration, not the only iteration. It could be worse. It could be different in a Trump 2.0 administration should that come to pass. But, you know, California and my office sued under my predecessor, the Trump administration, over 100 times for a lot of issues that, you know, that were high profile, like the Affordable Care Act, like DACA and immigration policy. But the majority of those 100 plus lawsuits were environmental and holding the Trump administration to account when they moved beyond their regulatory or executive authority, violated federal law, or infringed upon other legal jurisdictions, including our own. So we are prepared to do the same. We need to continue to lead this nation and this world. And if the Trump administration comes to pass and becomes an impediment and a challenge, we will stand up tall and strong and continue our pathway forward, including getting our waivers so that we can be even more aggressive than the rest of the nation when it comes to vehicle emission standards and other things.
That was California Attorney General Rob Bonta. We talked in front of a live audience at the Commonwealth Club as part of San Francisco Climate Week.
While some have the power to take their cause to the courts, others harness the power of people by going to the streets and the voting booth. Nayeli Cobo of Los Angeles was just 9 years old when she became a climate activist, and the fight was sort of thrust upon her. She grew up near an oil well and started having horrible health impacts. She told me about it when we had her on the show last year.
It all started with a nosebleed, and the first nosebleed, we didn't think much. You know, I probably didn't drink enough water that day. It was probably too hot outside. But the nosebleed came back 3 times that week. And every time they came back, it was more and more intense. It got to the point where the nosebleeds got so intense I couldn't sleep in my own bed anymore. I would have to sleep in a chair to prevent choking on my own blood. I developed asthma, and that's something I'm always going to have to live with now. I had heart palpitations and I had to use a heart monitor for several weeks. I got body spasms that were so intense, I couldn't walk. My mom would have to carry me from one place to the other. Unfortunately, the list goes on and on.
And it wasn't just her. Other kids and adults in her community were also getting sick.
My mom developed asthma at 40, which is really rare. And my grandma developed it at 70, which is unheard of. It was a common conversation starter for parents to stop each other in the streets and say, my son is in the hospital from an asthma attack. How's your daughter's asthma? Or my son is in the ER. Can you help me pick up my other kids from school? And that's not normal.
How did you connect the health symptoms that you just described with the oil well in your neighborhood?
So when drilling for oil, there are a lot of toxic emissions that are released into the air, and it typically smells like rotten eggs, which is really gross. Something the oil well in my community did was add even more chemicals to mask the smell. So then my community would smell of guava, chocolate, cherry, citrus. Out of nowhere, this smell started occurring. And the smell was constant. It was a smell that as soon as you took a breath and inhaled, you were sick to your stomach. We originally thought that something was wrong within the building that we were living in, you know, a leak, plumbing issues or some sort. And we started contacting the executive director of the organization that owns the affordable housing building. And we started calling them and they said, no, I assure you the building is okay. It's most likely the oil well across the street. And we said, the what? And it was up to us to become the experts and start learning what was going on in our community. So we started calling the South Coast Air Quality Management District and filing complaints. And then we were very fortunate to have Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles send a toxicologist to come speak to my community. And that's when we officially connected the dots and said, oh, this chemical used during oil extraction causes X, Y, and Z symptoms, and that's what we're experiencing.
Kobo and her mother began knocking on doors in their community, helping their neighbors learn about the dangers of neighborhood drilling. They spoke at rallies and government meetings and advocated for their community's health. Out of this effort, Kobo helped co-found the organization People Not Pozos, which means wells in Spanish.
Because I was so young, I didn't realize what I was up against. I just thought I was fighting grown-ups. And for me, it was, I can challenge a few grown-ups. But I did not understand that I was fighting big oil, a multi-billion dollar corporation. And I think it helped a lot not to know that at the age of 9.
But her activism took her away from the activities of being a normal kid, especially when she was a teenager.
It was difficult to be in high school and have all my friends go to this really cool event, this really cool party, this really cool dance, and I couldn't go. And while I was fully aware of the decisions I was making, and I would weigh the options as if, okay, what will serve my community better, going to this conference or going to this dance? And I would always choose the conference. But it is difficult when I remember this really cute guy asked me to his prom, and I said yes. And a week later, I got an opportunity to go to a conference, and I said, I'm so sorry, I will help you find another date. And it's those decisions that I know that will serve me in the long run, but it's hard in the moment as well.
After nearly a decade of raising the alarm, Kobo and her mom had a big break in 2020, when pressure finally drove the oil company Allen Co. to shut down the drilling site near her childhood home. Then, in 2022, the LA City Council voted to ban new extraction and phase out all drilling in the city over a 20-year period.
It's really powerful to know that a community that was viewed as invisible, as disposable, created historical change. You know, we said enough is enough. We are not invisible. We are humans, and we deserve to live a sustainable life. We deserve to live without being in fear of what we're breathing in.
But even with some successes, Kobo's health issues have become more serious. At age 19, she was diagnosed with stage 2 reproductive cancer. Yet, even during treatment, she's continued her work as an activist and organizer, fighting to get oil and gas drilling away from the homes and schools of her fellow Californians. And in 2022, she won the Goldman Environmental Prize. Coming up, we check in with Nayeli Kobo to hear about the next front in her fight against big oil.
I have a dream where urban oil extraction and environmental racism aren't learned about through lived experience, the way so many of us have had to learn and experience it, but it's learned about in history books.
That's up next when Climate One continues. Today we're featuring Californians who are fighting the oil and gas industry in different venues, the courts and the ballot box. Just before the break, we heard from LA climate activist Nayeli Kobo, who spent more than a decade fighting against fossil fuel extraction in her community and others. And she did all that while battling her own health struggles, likely caused by those same fossil fuels. Now, some of her hard-won gains are in danger of slipping. In 2022, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill that would block new oil and gas wells near homes, schools, and hospitals. Then, just days later, the oil and gas industry launched a campaign asking voters to repeal the law. So now it's on hold until the election later this year. I invited Kobo back on the show to hear how she's dealing with this setback.
So for over a decade, Californians, frontline community members, community-based organizations, and people that believe in people's right to breathe clean air had been tirelessly advocating on this statewide ban. It was us saying enough is enough and prioritizing people's health over profits. Almost 3 million Californians live a mile or less to an active oil and gas well.
Wow.
And we were prioritizing their health and well-being. It was a historic and incredible
change-making day when California Governor Newsom signed and implemented this into law, but it was attacked by the oil industry days later, and the oil industry is willing to spend $200 million on keeping this law overturned.
So what did you feel when you found out about this effort to kind of derail the work you and others had been doing for so long?
It's difficult to put into words. I mean, I remember the moment I found out that this had been passed. I was at a dinner in with my mom, and my phone just started blowing up. And I was like, why am I being tagged on Twitter so much? Like, what's going on? And it was that they had just voted unanimously. And it was, oh my God, I don't want to get emotional, but it was such a powerful moment because it was everything that we had fought for come to this moment. And it was like our finish line was finally in the horizon. You know, you could see the light, and that was taken from us. And that was something that belonged to the people. It belonged to the youth. It belonged to the future, to our elders. It was us taking our voices and our homes back and defending ourselves. To know that the oil industry is using yet again another tactic, yet again another intimidation tactic to add another fight, to continue to drill in our backyards and to continue to make profit off of our health. It's heartbreaking. It's upsetting. It's a mix of emotions because what we're fighting for is to open windows in our own home.
Right.
What we're fighting for is to have kids play outside and not have them trigger an asthma attack or a nosebleed. We're fighting to have kids sleep in their own beds in a sleeping position and not in the chair to prevent choking on their own blood at night. Like, this is life or death situation. And to know that it's still not enough.
Yeah. Well, Jane Fonda, California Governor Gavin Newsom, and former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger teamed up to defend this bill that you helped make happen and kickstarted the Safe and Healthy California campaign. And you were there with them. So tell me a bit about what that was like, kind of seeing your work elevated by these, you know, pretty notable figures.
It was an incredible day because it was a day full of hope. And it was us standing together in our unity in our community and saying, we are going to win. We are going to take the polls. We're going to take our voices and our strengths, and we're going to demonstrate to the oil industry that they have no place in our backyards, in our democracy, or in our future. It filled me with hope to be in that space with those individuals, to know that they are using their platforms to advocate for this, where the noise needs to be made, that they are willing to raise their fists in solidarity and to make, again, noise in this situation for our health, our safety, our environment, and to set a standard of what we should be prioritizing with our people in our states and in our nation.
So this is not the first time California has seen a fossil fuel-backed effort to change the law. Here's Schwarzenegger with Jane Fonda talking about this most recent bill.
But of course, this is kind of like a sequel. Because we have gone through this once before.
You've done it.
In 2010.
Yeah. Right.
That I put an initiative together that says, let's undo all the environmental laws in California. And we beat them badly. So, I mean, this is going to be a repeat. It's literally a sequel.
So what do you think when you hear former Governor Schwarzenegger saying so confidently that this initiative will be beaten and the law will be preserved?
It's something that fills you with hope because I have a dream where urban oil extraction and environmental racism aren't learned about through lived experience the way so many of us have had to learn and experience it, but it's learned about in history books. Mm. And it's powerful to know that former Governor Schwarzenegger also feels that. And it's a moment to know that we are on the right side of history. We are advocating for our basic human rights. And all of those moments that were so defining for so many community activists, that's coming up to now. Mm. This moment of us standing up for ourselves and raising our fists in the air and not taking no for an answer and saying we deserve to open our windows in our home, our kids deserve to play outside, our elders deserve to not be diagnosed with asthma at the age of 80, or to have to learn to use inhalers and other forms of medication in a second language that is not their native tongue. You can see the finish line and the lights in the horizon, but we haven't crossed the finish line.
You know, the big oil companies are hoping to appeal to consumers' wallets by saying that the law will make gas prices go up. We're talking about California. It's an environmental leader. So how successful do you think that tactic will be?
I mean, it's something that definitely frightens people. When you already feel like you're struggling to get to and from work with the gas prices, it frightens you to hear that this may be higher or that this may be a continuing reality. But the truth is that that's not the case. We wouldn't be paying the difference at the pump. It's another tactic that they're using to lie to us, to intimidate us, to continue to profit off of our health. And it's just us having to continue to raise awareness on these tactics. It's us raising education amongst each other on the fact that we will not be paying the difference at the pump, where we will not be having less oil for us, because all the oil that we're drilling, we're exporting anyways.
Mm. California Attorney General Rob Bonta has announced a lawsuit against five big oil companies for decades of allegedly misleading the public about the effects of burning fossil fuels on the climate. We have also seen the case where young people in Montana won their court case that regulators have to consider the effects of greenhouse gas emissions when they issue permits for fossil fuel development. What do you think about using the courts as a tool for climate justice?
I think it's an incredible tool that is being used because it's our democracy, it's our planet, it's our lives, it's our future. And to know that we are using every avenue possible to demand our justice, to demand environmental justice and climate justice, I think it's extremely admirable. I remember when I would be the only youth in the room, and to look around and see how many more youth are in the room is something that I get so excited because it's something that's so beautiful and so powerful. And it fills me with hope that our youth are stepping up and stepping into the world despite being told this isn't for you, or you should leave this to the grown-ups, or you should be in school. I mean, I heard that countless of times, and my response always was, you're right, I should be in school. But you're not doing your job at defending me or my planet that I have to be here. And I think I'm continuously inspired by the amount of youth that are stepping up to local and federal government to demand their justice, their future, and their rights to a thriving environment and to a clean and healthy environment. And again, it's our youth are the change. We are the future doctors, future lawyers, future presidents, future everything. And to know that we are taking our voices now and we are taking our stories now despite our age, despite our education, is powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, and your story is a really powerful personal story. And I think we've seen more people using climate storytelling as a, you know, kind of a tactic and trying to raise awareness. How do you think that effective storytellers can kind of compete with the huge amounts of money fossil fuel companies can throw at messaging and PR campaigns and so forth?
I think storytelling is a very compelling form of activism that goes unnoticed. And I think it's one form of activism that helps us understand each other on another level. You know, it's less about statistics or data or huge scary numbers. It's about a person whose life was severely impacted by this. And that's a lot easier for someone to listen and to hear and to relate to. Like when I share my story, it's easier for someone because they probably know someone who was 9 years old, either their child or their niece or their grandchild.
They can connect.
And it connects. And it's a way to empathize with another and to connect on a deeper level and to say, well, I've had headaches. I can't imagine having a constant migraine. Or I have asthma. I can't imagine having to be in school and having to be taken out via ambulance and everyone. Like that situations with storytelling, it's a very powerful tool that connects us, is the perfect word. And it's also a way of a storyline to show what we can do as individuals, as a community, as society. It's something that truly paints a beautiful story. And that's something that always makes me very happy as well.
2024 is a big year for climate, as about half of the world has or will be voting on leaders this year. And climate is a big part of a lot of those decisions. Here in the U.S., climate is one issue where Republicans and Democrats are pretty far apart. So the choices people make in November will be very important as to the window to address climate change and how that's closing. What would you tell voters as the election season draws closer?
I would definitely say to continue to educate ourselves. We can't create change unless we know what is wrong, and that starts with education and researching our top elected officials from national, federal level, all the way down to our local districts, because that's also so important. And educating ourselves on voting into office climate champions, people that haven't taken money by the fossil fuel industry, people that continuously prioritize the climate in their advocacy and their policymaking, whether they're pushing or delaying climate action, climate plans, climate procedures. This is such, like you mentioned, an all hands on deck election. Every vote matters, every person matters, every individual in and out of office is critical to our climate this election. And the most climate champions we can vote in, the better, because we have one planet and we can't continue to destroy her and expect to continue to live on her. It affects everyone. There's a lot of issues we should all put our differences aside for, but this is definitely one of them.
Yeah. Nayeli Kobo is a climate activist, 2022 Goldman Environmental Prize winner, and co-founder of People Not Pozos. Nayeli, thank you so much for coming back on Climate One.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a joy and an honor.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. You can see what our team is working on next week by subscribing to our newsletter, which also rounds up the biggest stories in the world of climate. Sign up at climateone.org.
Brad Marshland is our senior producer. Our managing director is Jenny Park. Ariana Brocious is co-host, editor, and producer. Austin Colon is producer and editor. Megan Basili is our producer and production manager. Our development manager is Wensi Shada. Our communications manager is Ben Testani. Jenny Lawton is consulting producer. Our theme music was composed by George Young and arranged by Matt Wilcox. Gloria Duffy and Philip Young are co-CEOs of the Commonwealth Club World Affairs, the nonprofit and nonpartisan forum where our program originates. I'm Greg Dalton.